Thank you, George. Thank you. Now, please, let's welcome our main speaker tonight, Charles.
All right.
How you doing, guys? My name's Charles. I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to those who identify as newcomers, and also those who maybe didn't identify but are new to Alcoholics Anonymous or to this area. I hope that you feel safe in the rooms of San Ray Valley in Alcoholics Anonymous and comfortable. You know, that's what I first felt when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in this area. I felt safe. You know, and I felt like it was a place that I could rest. And I felt that long before I was willing to do what was necessary to actually obtain any sobriety. So I think that oftentimes there's things that come before sobriety really comes. It's part of the process, and for me that was one of them, is being able to trust Alcoholics Anonymous. So if there's nothing in my experience or my message that makes you feel that way, I hope that you continue to come to Alcoholics Anonymous, whether it be here or wherever life takes you, that you do finally feel that way, and that you can find some comfort in your sobriety in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm usually a pretty long-winded person, and I've been recently in my life, I've been doing a lot of effort to work on my anxiety issues, and I've noticed that a lot of that has to do with my like OCD approach to time and trying to rush to get nowhere and do nothing. So you know what I mean? So I'm gonna really try to like look at people and slow it down a little bit and not say anything that's unnecessary, because I just, you know, it's where I'm at right now. So I will tell you a little bit about myself. I was born in Santa Maria at Marion Hospital. My mother and father were together at the time. I was raised in a loving home, but there was some dysfunction that was set aside through pure discipline in order to handle business. And my dad was young, and my mom was even younger. They were, you know, in their early 20s, and had a sister and brother that are twins that came 2 years before me. And my dad went to work on base for a contractor and, you know, handled a house and home and family and raised a dog, you know, by the time he was 7 years my prior, you know. And I didn't start seeing any, like, dysfunction until I was already a grown adult. And, well, that's actually not true, but until I was old enough to make my own dysfunction without the help of, like, conditioning from parents. So the reason that I say that is if you're having a hard time identifying, which is what this is all about, that's all meetings are for, in my opinion, is so that we can identify with each other. And I need to continue to identify in Alcoholics Anonymous regardless of how much time that I have, whether that's negative days or, you know, hopefully 30 years, you know. I'll still need to identify in Alcoholics Anonymous and feel connected to the people here, and know that there's a common solution to a common problem. And so the reason that I share my background, because it's irrelevant in regards to my alcoholism, because I've seen people that have come from all walks of background and all sorts of income and all sorts of parenting styles or lack of parenting become alcoholic. And I also know for a fact that there's many people in this room that could probably drink me under the table. You know what I mean? I had a lot of friends who could drink me under the table, and they ended up not being alcoholic. One day, as we got a little bit older, they set it down and they continued on with their life and went to college and, you know, started acting like men, you know? And so, you know, I do remember that when I was young, I was pretty sickly. You know, I don't get sick very often now, but like I had mono, and I missed like 3 months of school. I had really bad allergies. I had to wear these inserts in my shoes because my feet were all messed up. And I was always had really bad allergies. I had asthma and I had an inhaler, you know, but that contradicted with me always wanting to be outside because I was a really hands-on type individual. That's the way my personality is. I want to be involved in it. I want to experience it for myself. And so by the time we started getting into like third, fourth grade, you know, and we started like paying attention to adults, because at that time all of our parents smoked in our house. I remember my father, because it was legal back then, my father used to, before I could even talk, my dad used to like spell my name with a cigarette, you know, with the cherry at night. And that was like my goodnight story, you know what I mean? So when I got into like third grade, I wanted to try those cigarettes. You know, the first cigarette I smoked was a Newport. And I remember some of my other buddies whose parents didn't smoke started coughing and they set it down. And I wanted to smoke the whole thing, you know, and unlike prior president, I did inhale that cigarette, you know, and I enjoyed it, you know, and I liked the head rush that it gave me, because when I first started smoking cigarettes, it actually caused an increase in my blood flow, you know what I mean? I could feel it, man. It gave me a sense of anxiety and was like, ooh, excitement, you know, because I can't, at that time I wasn't in touch with my feelings enough because I was so scatterbrained that I couldn't tell the difference between like a stimulant-induced anxiety and real excitement for life, you know? And so I enjoyed that. And I remember going to the library in fourth grade, and it was the first time I kind of like got called out on it, because I always had good grades and I was well-mannered and realized I could get away with a lot, you know, if I didn't tell you what I felt about you with my face or with my words. So I tried to act appropriately and, you know, do what I wanted to do when you weren't watching, right? And so she says, you smell like cigarettes. And I just said, my parents smoke in the house. And that was it. That was it, you know. And that worked until I smelled stronger than my mom, you know. And she's like, you know, and my sister and brother laughed. They were like, we've been waiting for 2.5 years for you to find out he's been stealing your guys' cigarettes and smoking them, you know. So then that progressed in seventh grade into, I actually used some marijuana first before I ever drank. And it was funny, but I remember I kind of actually like blacked out the first time that I used it, you know, and I went on to have a really good relationship with that substance. But at first I honestly didn't like it a whole lot. And so... I started drinking because my friend's mom was an alcoholic, and she didn't need to drink so much, you know, and it hurt our feelings when she drank and either became really manic and weird, you know, or angry and make us all leave, you know, including one of my best friends at the time. And so we you know, did what any good-willed kids should do, and that's steal her vodka and drink it. You know, and it was real quality pop-off vodka, you know. And I remember I was the guy that would end up watching over my friends. You know, we drink just as much, and they'd black out and see the clock at 2 o'clock in the morning and think it was soccer or football practice and put on their gear and start running around the house, you know, thinking they're at football practice, and I'd be standing there, like, watching over them. And that's kind of when I first started experiencing, like, the fact that like alcohol affected me differently than it affected other people. I kind of knew that right off the get-go, you know, that, I don't know, I hesitate to say that it took away like my seriousness, because tequila did do that, but that was the only drink that did that for me, which is why it became my number one. But, you know, my best friend growing up was Mexican, and I love that culture for their respect for alcohol, or lack of respect, you know. But it was great, man. He had his grandfather was an agave cactus farmer in Jalisco, Mexico, and he'd come up with mezcal, and we were allowed to drink, you know, because we wanted to. And if you wanted to, then okay, you know. And my parents knew, and his dad would control us and keep us in the house, you know, and we'd eat menudo in the morning, and, you know, it's just like that was just the way it was. It was okay. And then we all kind of started falling off off the edge, you know. And our grades started dropping by eighth grade. All we wanted to do was skate and drink, you know, honestly. And we hung out in ditches and the tunnels, you know, where the ditches connected between the streets of the city. And I'd stay up all night doing my homework because I wanted to maintain this dual personality. I couldn't afford for you to not have respect for me, you know? But I also couldn't afford to do what I needed to do to continue to have respect for you people in the daytime, you know? So I handled school, you know, and I'd get away with everything. And at this time, like, people started verbally saying things to my friends, teachers, other people in class, you know, about them dropping off the edge. And for whatever reason, I kind of got like a pass, you know what I mean? I'd skate by. And that came to an end starting in high school. I found some other substances that are a little bit harder in nature and a little bit harder on your body. And I started using a lot of those stimulants to keep me awake so that I could do my homework in the middle of the night, you know, because I wanted to go out and have fun all night. And eventually it just like, I couldn't hang, man. And I became more and more withdrawn and my anxiety got worse and worse. And at the same time, my desire to isolate was getting stronger. My codependency issues were also getting really strong as well. But I didn't even know that's what it was, you know? So as like, as much as like, I want your attention and I want you to like me and I want to be a part of your life and I want you to be a part of my life, at the same time, when it really came down to it, real life, I'd rather just kind of like walk over here and go in the back room and not have to deal with that pressure, you know? So I left high school early and I masked it once again to try to make it look like it was a good thing. And I went to this College Now program, and really it was continuation school independent study work that we got like good credit for, as if we were doing an elevated amount of work in an escalated amount of time, you know? And I couldn't even handle that because there was too much time on my hands now, you know? And I went to Hancock and I took some Hancock courses and I got my ego fed because I was in college at the age of 16, you know, and then I'd hit the elevator button and on the way to math class and I'd smoke meth, you know, because my pride was so, you know, strong. And so I went to jail. I didn't graduate. I didn't graduate high school. I had 2.5 units. You need like 228 units to graduate high school, I think it is, 226 maybe. I had 2.5 units to graduate high school. I was on set to graduate high school in 2002 when my graduating year was 2003, and I didn't graduate until 2 years after I was supposed to graduate in 2003. And because there were more important things to do than have a future for myself, there were more important things to do than learn, you know, insignificant things. And those more important things were continue to break my relationships with my friends and my family, destroy my body, you know, and my spirit and my mind through the only medicine that I knew worked for me, which was mind-altering substances, you know. And alcohol was a constant. I used to have a fridge next to my bed from the time that I was about 14 years old, and I'd keep it stocked with beer and cold tequila and a mirror with cocaine on it, and I'd have to use alcohol and somas to, you know, to go to sleep. And you know, it was also like hydration. I remember we'd go camping and we wouldn't even have water. We just have beer. Like, we had Coors for hydration. You know what I mean? Like, that's where we got our water content. You know? And so what ended up happening was I started, during one of those camping trips, I got my father high one time, and we started getting high quite often together. And It started first with cigars and then tequila sunrises and then drinking pretty often, you know, and then one time it was like, why don't you smoke a blunt with me, you know, and then it turned into, why don't we take some lines so that you can go hiking with me, you know, and that became a pretty consistent thing behind the back of my sister and brother and mother. And so when that got exposed to my uncle, who also happens to be an attorney, my sister's brother, or my, excuse me, my mother's brother, the whole family found out about it. And it really wasn't good, you know, and I didn't know how to handle that when I was like 16 years old. I didn't know how much responsibility I was supposed to take for it. I felt really guilty. I felt like I was taking more conscious responsibility for how wrong it was than my own father. He never said sorry. Still to this day, he won't see it as the wrong thing. He was trying to teach me control. That's okay. Some people can control the use of those substances. I cannot. But what ended up happening was that after years and years of abuse of alcohol, multiple programs in town as a teenager, getting kicked out of teen court, doing that whole game, trying, you know, religious programs and things like that, it didn't work, seemed to work for me because I wasn't receptive. My mother told my father, you're gonna call the cops on your son this time rather than calling the ambulance. So my dad called the cops on me, and I turned 18 in juvenile hall, and they took away my ability to drive and all those things. And I just remember being in juvenile hall with other kids, and I felt so old. That's all I remember. I felt too old to be in there. I felt like I was like 30 years old. And I just turned 30, and now I feel like I'm 15. But I felt like all these kids are so young, you know what I mean? I just remember that, and I'm like, what am I doing here, man? And all my friends, you know, I just broke up with my girlfriend because I knew it wasn't going to work, you know. I was going to continue to, I needed, my real relationship was with alcohol. That's what my real relationship was. I couldn't handle losing her. You know what I mean? I can handle losing you, but I can't handle losing alcohol. And so you are going to go. This is going to stay. And then, you know, I go to jail, or if that's juvenile hall was actually worse than county jail. It was pretty bad. I mean, it was a small cell. And I remember my dad came to visit me, and I wanted to murder the man. I remember thinking, like, I'm going to murder you, you know? It was that betrayal. You know, I felt betrayed by my own dad. And I remember getting out and finding out, you know, what did I do? I went back to live under my dad's house. Like, so, yeah, I can talk crap all I want, but I was living under his roof, you know what I mean? So, but I remember finding out that, like, people, like, were coming by because they wanted to get hooked up or whatever, and my dad was asking them, do you have anything, you know? And they're like, you just locked up our connection. So, that really pissed me off, man. I had heavy resentments against my father, heavy resentments, and I knew I was going to be just like him because my brother was not like him. So it's like, I got my father's genes, right? I got those genes. I'm going to be just like him and all my other Okie family that loses their teeth by 35, never amounts to anything, is hated by their children and their parents, hates everybody else in their family, doesn't get along with society, and ends up living in the trailer, you know. So far, I have lost most of my teeth. That did happen. But I love my family. I don't have any children, but I'm pretty sure I'm going to love them when I do have children, you know. I have great relationships with my friends, and I don't have the best relationships with my father today. In fact, we don't really have a relationship, but that's because I've been taught healthy boundaries through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous and from the council of men in this program, who have taught me that the most respectful thing that I can do for myself and my father is to not have a relationship at this time, you know. And so what ended up happening is after I got incarcerated for that trip, I was ordered to detox, even though I was already like 27 days sober. And I was sent to detox in this town for 28 days. So I got a little gold certificate, you know, for graduating detox. And it was the first certificate that I had ever received. It was the first thing that I had ever completed. I remember that. I still have it. I should have brought it. And, you know, So, but I remember there was this cool chick working there who was a lesbian, and she was sober for 5 years, and she lived in AG, and she was like 33. And at that time, I was just turned 18, you know, and I remember, wow, like, she's probably like the youngest person I've ever seen that like I knew drank like I did and got sober and was doing something, you know. And she had a good message, because what did she do with that? She got back into service, and she was working at a detox, and she was meeting it at ground level where the alcoholics still smell, you know what I mean, where people are still learning how to get on their feet, where their relationships are toxic, you know, and their finances are a ruin. I mean, it's one thing to like get sober and put on a tie and sit with a bunch of other people wearing ties. It's another thing to get sober and go back and carry the message to the person that looks and smells and feels like I did when I first came to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that's the kind of Alcoholics Anonymous that was attracted to me when I first got here, and I hope to God that that kind of Alcoholics Anonymous always sticks. And if I can do anything about it, I'm going to do my best to be that kind of a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And for that reason, I've always had the Golden Group, because it carries a grassroots approach to Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And so in that detox, I was introduced to meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous, mandatory. I met some really cool people. We laughed a lot. We ate a lot of instant mashed potatoes. We got some salmon and some other things, complimentary of Michael Jackson. That was pretty amazing. At that time, the detox was not where it is now. It was in another place. It was in like a double wide trailer. The carpet smelled like dirty feet. There were bugs. And my friend was detoxing from cocaine, and so he was really angry. And his name was Keith. And they had to send him to an anger management thing. So we started called Green Acres. You know, so we made a song for him. Green Acres is the place for Keith. You know. Man, you know, and there was unhealthy relationships between the women's room and the men's room, and there was this one dude who like had a boat. I won't tell you what its name was, and he'd knock on the wall and wake up the girl next door and like whisper to her through the wall and do weird things, you know. But that's what I, you know, that's where I was. That's what life is like when you're living in crack houses drunk all the time, you know. And so, you know, I used to be really hard with my approach to Alcoholics Anonymous. I used to be really legalistic, almost religious about it. I want to talk about drugs, you know, and I heard one person say, like, if drugs are an outside issue, why do I put them in my body, you know? And why did every member, almost, there's only a few stories in the Big Book that the people didn't use drugs, actually. So, and I'm also taught, I heard my friend say this the other day, which I really liked, is, if drugs are an outside issue, then I could use drugs and not have to claim a new sobriety date. You know, so for me, drugs are not necessarily an outside issue, but it's important to acknowledge that this is Alcoholics Anonymous. Because there are human beings who only drink. And it's important for those members to know that there is a primary purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, which is to carry the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, not Narcotics Anonymous, and vice versa, because there are some people who are not, you know, have issues with both, and but that's not me, and I'm speaking tonight, so you will hear about drugs to a certain extent. But the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous not only kept me sober from alcohol, it kept me sober from drugs as well. So I don't, you know, I don't buy into the fact that the Big Book and the 12 Steps of Alcoholics Anonymous isn't enough. Although I do attend multiple fellowships. So if you're new in Alcoholics Anonymous and you're feeling kind of out of place about that, because I was out of place about everything. I didn't know where my mind was. I was like a BB in a blender in my brain. And I didn't know what to think, you know what I mean? I didn't know if the all-inclusiveness of the spiritual side of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous was okay for me, being brought up in a really religious background, thinking that there was only one God, and am I going to go to hell if I sit and pray the Father's Prayer holding hands with people that probably worship Satan? You know what I mean? That's how I felt. Like, I didn't know if I could be in Alcoholics Anonymous Because of that, I didn't know if I could be in Alcoholics Anonymous because I did use drugs, and should I not share that? You know what I mean? And so if you're new, I hope that once again that you can feel safe enough to be authentic and listen to somebody who actually has your best interest involved rather than them being right and pious about their opinion about the way that Alcoholics Anonymous should be. So I'd like to say that I stayed sober that time. After that, I got quartered or two. After that home, I got transferred directly into a men's home for a year. And I did not stay sober. The first night I was in there, I was offered a handful of Vicodin and I took them. And that continued. And on my night passes, I would drink. When I'd go visit my grandfather in Oklahoma, I'd get to about New Mexico, and I'd smoke weed one time, so that for the next 3 weeks I could clean out by drinking lots of water before I got back to Santa Maria and had to test for probation. And I'd be careful not to get in trouble. I would only do it in controlled environments with certain people. And I managed that, you know. And I came to meetings, a lot of meetings. I fixed up a bike that I got out of the trash. I got it stolen from me. I lived up on the north end of town. I did general relief to pay for my men's home, you know, and I did like work on the side. I had no car, I had no friends, I had no girlfriend, I was losing my teeth. I'd stay up every night in pain as a result, and the only thing that I could do was hold my jaw and smoke a cigarette. I was smoking about a pack and a half a day. I was claiming sobriety and taking chips when I didn't even have 30 days. I thought I was a member. And I was, because the only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking, not having been sober. But I was not involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was not invested in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was not being authentic in Alcoholics Anonymous. Or with myself. And that's most important. Because if I'm not authentic with myself, if I'm not being honest with myself, then I'm sure as hell not being honest or authentic with some form of higher power or faith in anything. And if that's not going on, then I'm definitely not trusting you enough to be honest or authentic with you. And living like that can only hold face for so long, you know? And I went full force at it again. And so that ended badly in Lompoc, thanks to the police, and got a 4-year joint suspension, and it was pretty bad. The judge was upset, man. He wanted me to go to prison really bad, and I couldn't stay sober. I could not stay sober. I was you know, 18-month program, and then 4 years of joint suspension. So if, at any point, if I got in trouble during those 4 years, you know, I was most likely looking at prison unless I could weasel my way out of it with an attorney, which I had no money for. And I had to do programs, and like this time, I was not playing games. This time, I did not feel like putting on a pretty face for you and like carrying like myself like I got this, you know. I was upset, scared, knew that I had a problem, knew that I was an alcoholic, didn't know what that meant, even though I had been attending meetings for a year, and couldn't see any hope, you know. And the book says that rarely have we seen a person fail who's thoroughly followed our path, you know. And it talks about a seemingly, Al from our area, Al AM, used to always point that out, seemingly. He uses that word a lot, the seemingly good, the seemingly bad. Seemingly hopeless, you know. And hopeless in the dictionary is without salvation. So for me, there was no being saved from alcohol. I was hopeless in my own mind, you know. And there was one guy that I kind of believed, you know, and he was my counselor that I had to go to when I was first in that men's home. And I called him Boston Bill. I don't even know if he's from Boston, but he had like, I think he was from the Bronx, but he had an accent, you know, and when he'd laugh, I remember we being in class, and he himself was a member of our fellowship, you know, who had a pretty gnarly story, you know, and I liked him. And he was one of the first people that I had met in a long time that I actually liked. Because that was one of the first things that alcohol took from me, is my ability to like anything. All my hobbies, like even my own family, I despised them. I couldn't be happy for my sister when she got married. I was jealous and angry that she was being taken away to Europe. You know, I couldn't be happy that my brother was succeeding and his dreams were coming true career-wise, you know, with an education and things like that. I was jealous of his ability to be disciplined and set goals and meet those goals. You know, I couldn't be thankful for the household that my parents built and provided for me because, you know, I thought that I could do better and that I deserved better. And so when I met this guy and I liked him, it was like, well, that's kind of cool, you know. And he'd share something like in our group, in our co-ed group, our outpatient group, and he'd laugh. And when he laughed, it was so loud, you know. The guy would just laugh at himself. And I'm like, man, this guy is funny, and he laughs at himself, you know, and his laugh is contagious. And so I went and I talked to him. I'm like, listen, man, like, I'm supposed to be finishing this program in 4 months, and I haven't been able to give him one clean test. And I happen to know the director of the program, childhood, so she's been letting me ride. But she told me I got to be able to provide a clean test if I'm going to graduate from this program. And I don't know where I'm going to get the money to pay off the fine. And my whole life's a wreck, man. And I don't have anywhere to live, you know, because I was still living with my parents at the time. And he said, you know what you need to do? So I went back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And that time, I actually found out, like, what it meant to be an alcoholic. You know, while I was still drinking, I was given the Joe and Charlie tapes, which is a book study from a specific, like, convention that went, like, over the weekend back in the day. And my name's Charlie, and my best friend's name is Joe, so that was kind of cool. And I liked it. I could smell and taste the smoke in the room on those tapes, you know? And I liked the fact that they were tapes. So I had to go find a Walkman at the thrift store, and I'd go in the hot tub while drunk, and I'd read over my big book that had different sobriety dates scratched on the front of it, and listen to the Joe and Charlie tapes. And when it gets to the point talking about the steps in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous being equivalent to the recipe of a cake being baked, sure, you can change it around all you want. That's your choice. I mean, my grandma gives me I ask my grandma for a recipe for a cake that I like. You know, I could have added more stuff in there if I wanted to. If I want to, I can do whatever the hell I want. But is it going to come out desirable? Most likely not. If I put a bunch of baking soda in there, it's not going to taste good. Nobody else is going to like the way it looks or tastes. I'm not going to like the way it looks or tastes. But my pride's probably going to be like, eat the damn thing. You know what I mean? And that's the way that it is with our recovery. You know what I mean? When we're trying to mess around with a program that was set before us by people who learn through experience, not just a bunch of talk out the side of their necks, but through real experience, it doesn't need to be changed at all. It works, and it's been working for a long time, really well. And so instead of just, you know, trying to fit in because of, like, my dependency issues and not wanting to stand out, and just if I fall in line like a good little soldier, nobody, you know, I'll be overlooked. I can just fit in, I'll be overlooked, you know. I came in and it's like, I don't even know what it means to be an alcoholic. Like, I know I have a problem with alcohol, but that used to be a bragging right. Like, what does that really mean? You know what I mean? And guys started sharing with me. I started asking questions. I started calling people. The first time that I came in Alcoholics Anonymous, I called one person one time, and I didn't even listen to what he had to say. I can't even remember that conversation because I wasn't listening. I was just talking, you know? So this time I started coming around. I started paying attention. And I saw this, and I asked somebody, you know, like, I like that, but I don't really identify with that. And if that's our description of the alcoholic, what am I supposed to do with that? You know? And he shared with me how he identified as an alcoholic. And he said, when I drink and I try to control it, I am not enjoying it. And when I enjoy my drinking, I am not in any way controlling it. And I identified with that. You know, and instead of paying attention to the differences, I started exposing some of those differences and taking them to people who were armed with the facts of alcoholism about themselves, and so that they could reciprocate to me how they worked through those thought processes, how they worked through those doubts and reservations from the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? things like, well, I never lost a relationship, which is a flat-out lie. I never lost a house, you know. I never lost a car, got a DUI. Well, one, that's luck. Two, I was never old enough or disciplined enough because alcohol had a grip on my life so early to ever hold a job to get a house to lose. And if I kept doing it, I never would. With the way that I drink, I never would have a wife to cheat on or for her to leave me. I would have had children to resent me or despise me. I never would have had a house to foreclose. I never would have had, well, I would have had a car to get a DUI. That was just luck. So, you know, I started exposing those things and getting knowledge on what the actual program has to say about them. You know, so this is, the reason I share that is that somebody shared that there's no such thing as like victims in Alcoholics Anonymous. When we were young, our parents signed us up for baseball. Today, we sign ourselves up for baseball. You know what I mean? And the sponsor can encourage us, but this is our recovery. And I took full responsibility for my drug addiction and my alcoholism. Full responsibility. And I would do anything necessary to get what I needed. I would break down many walls that took me years to build up. And I would build walls that would take me, and still am, taking years to break down in order to protect my alcoholism and my right and ability to drink. So it's my responsibility to take that same type of approach with my recovery and with my sobriety. I have to respect it. I have to cherish it. I need to do the work necessary. And what I found out from being here this time and putting in that work is that before, I wanted what you had, and I wanted sobriety, but I wasn't willing to do what was necessary to keep it and maintain it, you know? I wasn't willing to respect it and cherish it for what it was, and so I didn't keep it. I gave it away, you know? And today, I don't remember where I came from. I don't remember the pain in my fingernails, you know? Or I don't forget the pain in my fingernails and the fact that I'd shaved my head because my hair hurt, you know what I mean? The follicles of my hair hurt because there were so many toxins in me. You know, the fact that my skin and my clothes smelled like cigarettes all the time because I had such bad anxiety and such hatred for myself, I didn't know how to do anything other than things that were harmful for my body, you know, to deal or cope with situations. I didn't know how to socialize or be around a group of people unless I was, like, fixating on something, you know. I couldn't handle looking people in the eye. I didn't want long-term relationships. You know, I didn't like to be exposed or vulnerable. These are all things that I got to work on in step work, you know, and it took me a long time. My sobriety date is October 3rd of 2005, and so I just turned 30 last weekend, and I got sober when I was 20, you know, and so my entire 20s were spent without anything stronger than an ibuprofen and zero alcohol in my body, you know? And so I've also seen people come to Alcoholics Anonymous being, you know, 60 years old and older and get sober and stay sober, you know? So it doesn't discriminate. Alcohol doesn't discriminate, and that's why Alcoholics Anonymous doesn't discriminate. You know, the program works for anybody. And they told me not to leave, you know, 5 minutes before the miracle happens. And the miracle really happens the second you come into Alcoholics Anonymous, even if you don't stay here. Really. You know, that's a miracle. If you make it into this room, it's a miracle. I have friends that died before we were ever 20 years old, directly from alcohol, literally drank themselves to death, you know, and they never got introduced to Alcoholics Anonymous. So if you're in this room, if your ass has graced a room of Alcoholics Anonymous, you've been blessed. You've had the opportunity for sobriety, and there are no more excuses, period. There's a solution for our alcoholism. We do not have to take a drink no matter what we face. No matter what we've done to somebody else, no matter what somebody else has done to us, there is no excuse to take a drink of alcohol. None. If I take a drink of alcohol and I get drunk, it's because I want to take a drink of alcohol and I want to get drunk, period. You know, I've faced things in my sobriety that I didn't have to face when I was drinking. I've buried some of my best friends who were my friends and always will be my friends, and I'll bury more. I've had to watch people struggle with their alcoholism, not take it serious, or take themselves too serious and not their recovery serious enough, and not stay. And they've died as well. And I've also seen people who were very, very bad and people who weren't that bad find a home in Alcoholics Anonymous, work the steps to the best of their ability, not fast as possible, but to the best of their ability, and stay sober and become very comfortable and become very functional and become very sociable and become very beautiful people, you know, and enjoy their lives. And that, if that isn't hope, man, if that isn't being saved from alcohol, I don't know what is. You know, and I'd have to say that I have not been able to find that in regards to alcoholism anywhere else. You know, not in the way that it is in Alcoholics Anonymous, because we're an all-inclusive fellowship. No matter where you come from, no matter how bad your alcoholism was, it can actually be used sometimes even more strongly in your recovery. It can be an asset to other members who need to hear your story, that you can recover from that and walk through it with grace and with your head held high, with confidence in yourself and a relationship with a higher power, and carry that message so that they can do the same thing. Because that's what this is all about. You know, and still, you know, I'd like to say that you might, you know, you can trust everybody in Alcoholics Anonymous and you won't be judged. It's not the case. We're human beings. We're a hospital. There's sick people here. You know, and that includes me on some days. I don't always I don't always represent my higher power very well. I don't always represent Alcoholics Anonymous very well. But I try my best, and I do a lot better than I used to do, you know, and I hope to do better. And I thank God, both for the newcomer, but also for the people with time. Because there's people, there's men sitting in this room who I've shared times of my life with, you know, and when I just look at them, it's an Ebenezer, you know, it represents things that I've had to walk through, and it reminds me of where I've come from. And in the same step, it tells me where I'm going to be able to go if I stay sober, you know, that I'm going to be able to offer that to somebody else in due time if I continue walking the way that I'm walking, you know. And so while you can't maybe trust everybody as individuals in Alcoholics Anonymous, I guarantee you if you stick around and you pay attention, there will be people that you find that you can trust. Because I've found people that I could trust in Alcoholics Anonymous more than anywhere else. Anywhere else. I found more unconditional love in Alcoholics Anonymous and in the steps than anywhere else. And the program is in the book. There's a lot of opinions. A lot of what I've said tonight is opinion because it's my experience. But the program is in the book. And that cannot be disputed. The program is the program. And the program is loving, it's gentle, and it's constructive. You know, and it's always trust. I can always trust the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, period. I don't know, like, for me, this past year, I've had to learn how to stay 5 minutes after the miracle happened, you know. Miracles happened in my life, and I've been able to get a good life, you know, and we forget, I speak for myself, I forget what it really means to be in pain. The book talks about we are undisciplined, and it lists out some certain things that we do each and every day. And as a result of doing those things, we allow God to discipline us. And when we do that, we find ourselves in less fear of some very specific things. We don't tire so easily, and we have more energy, and we tackle things that used to be huge obstacles with pretty much ease, you know? And we can get through them with grace. But it doesn't matter if I don't take a drink. I don't have to take a drink to suffer from alcoholism. You know, and that's an Al-Anon saying, but that applies to the alcoholic as well. I do not have to take a drink to suffer from my alcoholism. And I don't have to take a drink for the people in my life, my girlfriend, my family members, my friends, to suffer from my alcoholism as well. It can be in full force, and sometimes in today, because I know how to get dressed and show up and be a service and show up to work on time and do these things, you know, without taking a drink. I got that handled like clockwork because it's habitual, right? And I think that, like, I can somehow handle doing things or handle things that previously I couldn't emotionally handle without having to take a drink. But I forget how sensitive I am. I forget that I am just today as self-destructive as I was when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And once those consequences start piling up, and once those emotions get too much, it will only be a matter of time until that drink looks attractive. That I'm going to need some form of escape that will not work. I don't believe in normal and not normal. I don't believe in that. I believe in alcoholic and non-alcoholic. You know, and what makes me an alcoholic is that once I take one drink, that phenomenon of craving kicks in, and I have to have more. I have to have more. So I have to do everything that's necessary for me to not have that phenomenon of craving kick in, to not have that obsession of the mind kick in. And if I'm going to prevent that obsession of the mind to anesthetize my emotions with alcohol, then I need to not do the things that are going to make me irritable, restless, and discontent. And sometimes, after time, what that means is doing certain things. When I was new, that meant refrain from doing certain things. Now, today, what that means for me is I have to do certain things. Because just the same as my tolerance for alcohol got greater the longer that I drank, and it took more alcohol to get me drunk, in my recovery, I have to do more in order to be okay and be happy in sobriety. Because I can be sober in my recovery, or I can be happy with my recovery. And those are two different things. And the truth of the matter is that coming up on my 10th year this year, I have not been very happy in my sobriety. And I'm not ashamed to say that, because I know that that's the experience of anybody who stays around Alcoholics Anonymous for any amount of time. We just look at the amount of birthdays that we have between 5 and 15 years, and there's not a whole lot. What happens? We get complacent. I can afford new boots for my birthday. You know what I mean? I can come around and just like be like, oh, I love this person, I love that person, and take it for granted. So my higher power has a way of ushering me in right where I need to be right at the right time. You know, and right now, I don't want to be exposed. I don't want to be vulnerable. I don't want to share with you about how I'm feeling. I just want to handle my responsibilities, cook dinner, and go to bed. And that's where I'm at. But that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter how I feel, and it doesn't matter what I want. It matters what I do. And that's how my sobriety works. And so I hope that that's a, you know, I'm not gonna hide or lie about that. And I love you all, you know what I mean? Even if I don't know you, I love you, and that's why I'm here. That's why I'm here carrying my message, you know? And, you know, whether you're new or you're, you know, you have some longevity and experience and sobriety, I hope that you keep coming back, because, you know, this would be weird if I was talking to myself. So I thank you guys for being here tonight, you know, and listening to my story. I thank you for the people who have been there for me throughout this year. And that's it. Thank you.